Okay, we're going to discuss rate regulation.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everybody. As Hans says, we're here to talk about rate regulation and to continue to develop an accounting model for activities subject to what we're calling defined rate regulation. And this morning we're going to be focusing on the role of uncertainty in the recognition of assets and liabilities. Although the focus of today's discussion is paper 9B, we've provided paper 9A as a reminder of what we mean by defined rate regulation and what the model is aiming to account for. So defined rate regulation is a formal regulatory framework that creates a combination of different rights and obligations for a supplier or suppliers of essential types of goods and services in a market in which there's only a single supplier or a very limited number of suppliers. And within the rate setting requirements of defined rate regulation, there's a rate adjustment mechanism that's designed not only to control the amount of profit that an entity can earn, but also control the timing of the cash flows or the cash inflows from customers through the billings to those customers. The control of the timing of cash flows helps the rate regulator in a defined rate regulation environment to achieve objectives to improve the stability and predictability of the bills to customers and also spread the cost of regulatory requirements across different categories and different generations of customers. In previous discussions with the board, we've established that the purpose of the model being developed is not to capture the whole package of rights and obligations created by the regulatory agreement. Many of those are already captured by existing IFRS. Instead, the purpose of the model is to account only for these temporary or timing differences created by the rate adjustment mechanism. And those timing differences arise when the regulatory agreement identifies that the regulated rate in one period includes amounts related to specified activities that the entity carries out in a different period. In the June meeting, we looked at five straightforward examples of common types of temporary differences arising from that rate adjustment mechanism to help us focus on the principles of the model. One of those examples is reproduced in Appendix A of Paper 9A, just for convenience as a reminder. In this and future meetings, we're going to change some of the assumptions in those straightforward examples to introduce more complexity. And in this meeting, we're going to introduce uncertainty as a factor in considering which of these adjustments to recognise as assets and liabilities. So in paper 9B, which is the focus of our discussion, we consider three types of or three sources of uncertainty envisaged in the revised conceptual framework. And that's uncertainty about the existence of an asset or liability, uncertainty about the outcome of the cash flows related to the asset or liability, and uncertainty about the measurement of the asset or liability. In paper 9B, we make suggestions about how uncertainty could be approached in developing the model. But at this time, we're not going to be asking the board for decisions about the criteria to include relating to uncertainty, because there is a lot of crossover between recognition and measurement. And so at this time, we're asking the board in paragraph 36 of paper 9B for comments and initial views about the role of uncertainty that will help inform proposals for both recognition and measurement that will bring to a future meeting. We're not intended to go through paper 9A separately during this meeting, but if anybody has got any comments on it, then we're happy to take those at the end of the session, or if it's relevant during the discussions of paper 9B, we can take them during those discussions. But with that, I will ask any comments on questions in paragraph 36 of paper 9B.
Mary.
Jane, I'll pick up on uncertainty. Maybe just first make a comment or two, because you said if you have any comments about 9A, I think 9A very helpful as a reminder about some of the issues we're wrestling with, and I think it would be good to go back, because I think the uncertainty issues that you raise, you know, we're, before we go too far down the track of thinking about how we address them in recognition and measurement, we might have some questions about if different types of uncertainties have different implications for the meeting the definition. So I just wanted to kind of say, let's note that and go back and think about that later, and then let's look at uncertainties in the context of this paper. Because what I wanted, first of all, I think it's really good that the staff kind of stepped back and looked at uncertainty as a separate issue. When I think back to some of the earlier overviews, one of the early suggestions was, let's just think about taking the same kind of approach that we took in IFRS 15 in terms of variable consideration and build off that kind of thinking. And I think it is really good to have stepped back and said, let's stop and think about the different kinds of uncertainty that could come out in a rate-regulated environment, and let's step back and think about the different ways in IFRS standards that we've addressed uncertainty, and so we can maybe start mapping which we think are right for different circumstances and different sources of uncertainty. The one kind of category I want to give a shout out to and say let's think about a bit more is uncertainty about the ability to recover because of uncertainty about what we call Q, the quantity that you sell. So let's say that based on the activities in the current period, the rate regulator says set the price per unit as such that if the expected Q is met, you'll get five more of revenue. That the additional five that we're talking about. If the rate regulator says, and then if Q isn't budget, you'll only get a further adjustment if the difference between estimated and actual is plus or minus 10. If the adjustment that you're being given is only 5, and it's subject to a range of plus or minus 10, I'm not sure that you've actually been given an adjustment of 5. Because you, as the regulated entity, are being forced to take what I'll call demand risk, in that circumstance. So, it's like if I say to you, I'm giving you 5 pounds, but you may have to, you may not get to keep it. You might have to give it back to me. I don't know that I've really promised to give you 5 pounds. And so I think that cue uncertainty starts to make the promise look more like the ability of a non-rate regulated entity. They can try raising their prices, and if they raise their prices, they may or may not get the total revenue volume that they expect, because there may be a consequence of price raising that impacts demand, or there may just be, they may raise their prices and then something happens that there's less demand for their product. So I think I'd like to look at that kind of uncertainty and what the accounting for it is, separate from the other kinds of uncertainty that you describe in this paper, because another type that you identify is there's a regulatory compact, there's an allowance in the system for repairs and maintenance that are your obligation. But there's a note that if there are unusual repairs, you have store damage, etc., you may get an extra payment.
Yeah.
Okay. And question about, is this so big it's storm damage, or is it part of regular? That's the kind of uncertainty that I could see being more I'll call it recognition or measurement issue, because it's within the context of the agreement. Mm-hmm. Because I think you're right, there are I would expect that anybody who is within the scope of this standard, there would not be question about whether or not there's a valid regulatory agreement. So I think you're right to say let's not focus on that kind of uncertainty. So I can see some for the recognition and measurement models that you described from other standards, but I think we should think about the demand risk set separately.
Thank you. So I'm not doing that in a particular order other than how I structured my own notes. So you asked comments, and I agree with your conclusion on the existence and certainty. On the paragraph 34 that deals with measurement, I don't disagree with the conclusion, but I would like to highlight the fact that I expect a lot of uncertainty as to the period of recovery, and that may be something to look into a bit more closely as to the consequences it may have. And on the recognition threshold, I must admit that on this one I'm really very hesitant. I'm hesitant in different ways. What I understand of the this rate regulated industry is that you have a certain number of things which are really clearly defined that bear, in fact, no uncertainty. But you have also, on the fringe, elements which come under the scope of for form of negotiation. So the core of the system will be basically on very clear contractual terms, but you may have pluses or minuses that really rely on how you reach agreement with your regulator. And I would expect that on that fringe, the negotiation with the regulator would largely affect the asset side more than it would affect the liability side. But when I get to that observation, maybe in fact my conclusion should be not that there would be something like, I don't know whether it's a recognition threshold or it's limiting what meets the definition of an asset to what really depends only on the contractual terms. I don't see whether I'm clear or not, but it may be a question of wording, but maybe the elements that stem from the contractual agreement would meet the definition of an asset, and then you would leave the part that falls under the negotiation out of the scope of recognition. But
oh, yes.
It would not be the result of saying, well, I want a higher threshold.
Yeah. So but I think that's pushing it more into the existence uncertainty where the regulation isn't clear enough define. Thank you.
But I hesitate, frankly.
Yeah.
Thank you. On that uncertainty issue, if you see the paragraph 21 of paper 9B, I personally think kind of we need a kind of a probability threshold in recognition. So I prefer just a normal probable threshold like in IAS 12 or our other standards. So I prefer to include the threshold, and also specifically I prefer probable. And also, I would like to have a kind of symmetrical threshold for assets and liabilities. But you are suggesting these questions because do you have any special things we have to consider in this rate-regulated activities? I don't think any big difference between the other transactions under the competitive market and this one. So do you have any special consideration? Because if this is a regulated environment, we should emphasize, focus on more other factors. Do you have any such kind of factors that are quite special in this setting?
I think the factors we've kind of tried to highlight in the various papers, so a little bit like a taxation agreement, there'll be some aspects where it's absolutely clear what's included, but then there may be some interpretation needed around the wording that's in the regulatory agreement. There is the question that Mary raises about the demand risk and whether that is clearly with the customers through the regulatory agreement, or whether there is a band where there may be some variation that isn't captured by the adjustment mechanism. So I think there's lots of issues, but I don't think the rate regulation itself is unique in that respect. I think we can see parallels with lots of other things, which is why we've suggested looking across different IFRS standards to see where the circumstances are closest that perhaps might give us some direction of travel.
It seems to me, you know, uncertain tax positions or some of the consequences of a, you know, court decision or litigation, they have the similar factors, uncertainties. So I don't think there are any very extraordinary differences from these factors compared to those factors in other settings. That's why I prefer just the normal threshold and normality of symmetrical things, as in IAS 12. Okay. That's one thing. Another thing is a kind of a unit of account to evaluate these uncertainties. Whether you suggest the five examples, right? So each example might have a different uncertainty of the approval of this rate regulator. So we are considering these specific rate adjustment transaction or item separately in assessing this uncertainty, while we are aggregating every, you know, interrelated components of these five examples. So I'm just wondering, the unit of account might be an issue to assess this uncertainty. I prefer just, you know, the combining everything, because this is just the regulator and the entity in the baby, the IS 12, the uncertain tax position. There are many items of tax expense or tax income gains, but they are just combining everything. Yeah. So if we compare it to the model in IS 12, so that's the another thing we should clarify, the unit of accounts here.
Yeah. So, I mean, with those five examples, obviously, to try and get through the basics and the principles, it's always a lot easier to look at straightforward, simple examples in isolation. But you're absolutely right. We get to the point, and I think it covers the points that both Mary and Françoise has done. We often have several different adjustments coming through the mechanism at one time. And at the end of the day, some of them are absolutely crystal clear and go through. But then as you build up a body of them, you may get into a position where the total amount of them might start to cause pressure on the demand risk. Others might be slightly less clear, and you do end up with a negotiation of the regulator and possibly a little bit of horse trading between amounts to try and reach an equitable settlement. So at the end of the day, we need to consider both factors. So one, looking at individual types of transactions or individual adjustments, but then make sure we come back at the end to look at the overall effect.
Stephen.
So Francois said earlier, if I got it correctly, negotiations with the regulator affect assets more than liabilities. So I'd like to question that and whether that's actually true, because it seems to me that we have a regulatory agreement and it can sometimes give rise to assets and sometimes liabilities, but I'm not sure there's a difference fundamentally between them. And I think also she was saying, suggesting that maybe assets only recognised if they're contractual, and the liabilities would be recognised more frequently for something other than contractual. And I thought, Jane, you nodded at this. Maybe I got that wrong or not, but maybe you were just acknowledging what she was saying. Because I don't see there is a difference, and I think it's very important that this is symmetrical. Because I think it's all about the P&L, and as soon as you make the recognition asymmetrical on the assets and liabilities, it's going to destroy the P&L.
Yeah, I mean, I think my nodding is acknowledging, I suppose, from the regulator's point of view, they're going to be arguing harder about not allowing some of the positive adjustments that would create the assets, whereas I guess the balance comes from the company negotiating the fact that some of these liabilities shouldn't be recognised as an offset. So I think in terms of the strength of the negotiation, you've got things going both sides, which has different effects depending on which side you're looking
at. But there would be, from the perspective of the company, if some of those assets and liabilities are still subject to negotiation, obviously there are asymmetric incentives, namely to make assets as big as possible, because the regulator will try to talk them down and not up, and to make your liabilities as small as possible, because the regulator will probably want to increase them rather than...
Sure, the regulator and the company have opposite incentives in terms of the flow of money, but I don't think, I mean, that's the case in almost all business transactions, and that doesn't affect the accounting.
Yes, but in most business contract, these assets and liabilities are not, during the process, not subject to negotiation.
No, it's regulation, but then it is the interpretation. It's like taxation, isn't it? It's no different.
I think it's very similar to the uncertain tax positions.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there should be a threshold in terms of existence uncertainty, but I think that's most likely to be satisfied pretty quickly and easily, because you either know you're in the regime or you're not. But then in terms of recognition, I think that should be symmetrical, and the measurement should be, well, probability weighted amounts or most likely or whatever it is, but it should apply equally.
So more akin to the current tax that's in IFRIC 23, the uncertain tax position.
Martin.
And as Stephen said, it is all about P&L, and I think we're doing this project because we want to see more what is the economic performance of this kind of entities, and therefore I think measurement uncertainty plays for me a very high role here, because man, if we develop a standard which, and as you have described in paragraph 18 following, that there is a lot of estimation and judgment involved, and if the outcome is then, for example, they do maybe all the estimations, but then they have to revise this estimate, which also has to go through P&L, which I assume, and all these adjustments would not reflect really the proper economic P&L, I think we don't have done a good deal, and I would think we have not achieved what we want to achieve. And therefore, I think I'm not an expert in this kind of stuff. I would be really interested in kind of, but my understanding is the more schemes which are modern, which are more on targets and this kind of, not really in our examples which we discussed in the earlier meetings, it was very precise and clear. But I think that is not the real world. The real world is more a kind of where they give targets and do estimation judgments. And for me, it would be interesting, okay, if we would have some evidence how often they have to adjust and to revise this. Because if that is a kind of a big number, or material numbers, I think, which has to go through P&L, which I assume, these adjustments, then it would result in that we don't reflect really the economic performance. And then I would have a big problem out of that. And therefore, I think we need a little bit more evidence, intelligence. Is it often? Is it big amount? Is it small amounts? And does it maybe differ in different regimes? Because I had a session in Germany where they tried to provide me with some more intelligence about that, but that was very difficult to understand. But my understanding was they agreeing something, and then after 5 years, then it was this audited, or maybe then renegotiated, and pros and cons. And so for me, it sounded not very precise numbers. It was a little kind of up and downs and up and downs. And based on better information also, then during this 5-year period, a lot of adjustments. And I would really be interested, before we develop a kind of model, that we have a little bit more intelligence. Could the numbers be big, or is it really immaterial, or do we discussing here an issue? Because, as I said, for me, the whole thing what we are doing is we're doing that to reflect the more economic performance of these entities. But if all this judgment and adjustments would destroy that, I think we don't should do this project.
I mean, in answer to your question, we've obviously tried to find evidence of the adjustments and the scale of the adjustments. I have to say, from what we've seen so far, there's very little evidence that there are material adjustments to these things once they've gone through the approval process. Because, as we've suggested in the papers, the regulators go through quite a heavy process of review before they will put through a formal approval. That's not to say it doesn't ever happen. Certainly, the longer the time period over which an adjustment is going to reverse through, the higher the risk that is. But from the evidence that we've seen, we haven't seen many examples of that happening. In terms of the ups and downs, I think there is another source of ups and downs, and this is this idea that each year we're looking at what variances or what adjustments there are each year. The regulators typically have a 3 to 8 year, in some cases, period where they set the framework for the rate during that longer period. But in each individual year, there is the true-up mechanism as you're going through that allows some adjustments to be made. But then we need to, and again, it comes back to this layering of the examples where we've looked at it. We know we've only got one example to look at a time. And the example in the appendix to paper 9A was a variance adjustment where we had a variance to our input cost only for the 1 year and it reversed the next year. But there are examples that we see where there's a variance adjustment in the first year. It reverses in the second year through the amounts we charge to customers, but then there's a new variance adjustment arises. And in some cases, it looks like a net off, whereas the mechanics is two separate adjustments. There's a reversal of the original one, and then there's a new origination in the second year. But if it's related to a similar input, then it can look as though it's just a change of an estimate, but it's actually two separate adjustments.
Just a small comment on the earlier discussion about the regulator being opposed to the entity. The regulator wants a fair price that also ensures a high quality long-term delivery. It is not going to always be the case that the regulator is opposed to the entity. I think we just need to look on a case-by-case basis and, you know, let the evidence speak for itself. I don't think we should make strong assumptions. The regulator is not the adversary of the entity.
No, but that's not what I said.
I was hearing that some people were saying that the regulator would almost always be trying to push the price down, I thought.
Well, there will be natural tendencies of most. But without them being adversaries.
All I'm suggesting is that there are other factors at play, and I don't think we should assume that's the prime driving thing that's going on necessarily.
We have seen some examples of regulators putting floors on prices to make sure that companies are charging sufficient to make sure that they're stable enough to keep delivering these essential services.
Thank you. I really appreciate the paper you wrote this month. I think the paper 9A, 9B, both are excellent. You successfully differentiate the rate-regulated industry from other ordinary industries. And you said that the rate-regulated industry has a different right and obligation that came from the rate-regulatory contract with the regulators. So you are saying that this is completely different right and obligations. So therefore, there is some outcome uncertainty or some measurement or recognition issue. But because they have the totally different right and obligation, it should be segregated from the recognition criteria of ordinary sales and purchase. So that is very clear. However, because it's so clear, it may create some consequence for future standard setting activity, because you are saying this is completely different activity. So therefore, it will remove the possibility of accounting choice or optional application of this standard. So therefore, once you have your activity and you have an assessment, then it falls into the rate regulated type. Then you have to obey this standard. That's the one consequence. And the other consequence is it will give lots more pressure on the scope issue. So once you make a scope of rate regulated industry, then it should be very crystal clear so that everybody can understand what is the rate regulated industry, who needs to apply this new standard, and those who is the industry who should not apply this standard. So therefore, I really look forward to the next discussion about scope.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gary.
Thank you. The also, I think, compliment the staff. Both papers are very written, very clear in a point. And a few comments which I think are consistent with others in there, but a little bit, perhaps a little bit different take on it. I think you have to step back. Look at the general environment this exists in. Stability and no surprises is in everyone's interest in this thing. It's certainly in the recipient of the electricity or gas or water. It's in the interest of the company, and it's in the interest of the regulator. You know, the regulator is essentially being appointed officials or politicians. I mean, surprises is not a good thing. And I think at the same time, the process and how it works and how rates are set, you know, what, you know, storm damage or, you know, P times Q issues. Again, these processes are very well known by all the players. In fact, companies survive, you know, in the industry by knowing how to manage these things. The regulators have the obligation to keep the company at least financially stable and to keep the customers, consumers satisfied. So I think that's the environment. I think we just need to accept that that's a given. I'll come back at the end where maybe we can't. But at the same time, just like in all accounting, there's low estimates and judgments, and they're just a part of the process. And if you draw an analogy to income taxes, and I know there's a number of analogies throughout this thing, but you close your books at the end of your fiscal year, it's many months, you know, before you finalize your tax returns. So you've closed your tax provision and tax assets liabilities based on a series of estimates and judgments that will get refined as you prepare your tax return, which will get refined subsequently upon tax audit and so on. And so it's just estimates, judgments, they're just a part of the process. We need to accept it. I think our standards are loaded with estimates and judgments. If you think of variable revenue, which I think Chung Wu had mentioned, deferred taxes, insurance recoveries, those who do government contracting are adept, if you're going to be successful, dealing with termination for convenience clauses and some which is just another type of uncertainty and so on. We just accept that. I think in the industry, and again, I did an awful lot of work in this, my first part of my career, they're my two biggest clients, is I think typically there's more than one regulated entity dealing with the same rate regulator. You know, you might have the north side of the river, someone else got the franchise in the south and so on, but you've got the same issues. And not everyone's in the regulator at the same time, but you do have the same issues. So you can start seeing how rate orders are being handled by, you know, your compadre companies, you know, that might be at a different timeline against decisioning or against the rate case than you are. So it's not like you're acting in a total vacuum. You're knowing where the flow of travel is going in the industry. I agree with Chung Wu dealing with paragraph 21. There's no, I think, whatever the standard, you know, for revenue recognition, I think it's just probable. I mean, we don't need virtually certain or anything like that in this case. And quite frankly, I think regulatory assets and liabilities got a whole lot more measurement certainty to them and outcome than do deferred tax assets and liabilities. It, with all that being said, I don't even think what we're talking, they're relevant, important, but they're not the most important revenue recognition in this project, things we haven't gotten to. For example, the what happens when you get a bill, it's just got a pre-funding component. You're going to build a new power plant. You're going to build a new reservoir, and you're starting to see the bill, the surcharge towards that. Is that revenue or is that a deposit? We haven't gotten to that yet, I don't think. Likewise, I think when you've got, you've incurred the cost and there's extended recovery and one significant financing component, I think we need to deal with that. And likewise, the whole premise of this is there's essentially no practical competition or viable alternatives. Well, I'm going to say the telephone utilities thought that once too 30 years ago, and then cell towers started emerging and so on. So I think we need to, at some point, when can you no longer hold that assumption that you've got a franchise that's virtually a monopoly? You know, does that change? Again, I don't know that that's central to the basic accounting, but I think we need to process that in time. And there's others as well, but I think these issues today are important, but I don't think they're central and difficult issues in the project.
Thank you.
Sue? I just wanted to follow up on the comments that Francois and Stephen were making, because I agree that I wouldn't want to see a sort of explicitly different level of certainty attached to assets versus liabilities. So, but I wonder whether it's more subtle, because I could imagine a situation where if I say I chose probable for argument's sake for both my assets and liabilities, if you had a situation where you had a very powerful regulator, and I take Tom's point, but let's assume it's a powerful regulator who's going to be more keen on prices staying down rather than going up to protect customers, you might in that situation more readily conclude that it was probable you were going to have a liability than you would conclude that it was probable you were going to have an asset. So I think even if we had the same test, the hurdle to meet the test might be different depending on which side of the equation you were on, depending on the sort of environment, the negotiations, the mindset of the regulator. So your outcome could be, I think, different even if you've got the same test. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but I can imagine if you really thought that the regulator's is going to want prices to go down, they may be much tougher to argue with for you to increase the price than the otherwise.
I guess I'm thinking about the implications of that because I agree that a lot of your negotiation depends on your relationship with the regulator, and I know certainly when we've been looking at the models that some of the credit rating agencies are using, one of the factors they consider is your relationship with the regulator and the track record of those negotiations. So I think you're right in terms of getting to your decision as to what's probable or not probable very much depends on the environment that you're operating in. To translate that into the model and the requirements that we can build into the model,
I'm not even suggesting that we do it explicitly. I just think that might be the effect of using the same word for both sides.
My reaction is probably, we use the same word for both sides, but maybe try and build in some application guidance to sort of build in some factors to consider when making your assessment as to what's probable or not.
Amaru?
Makes sense. Make reference. Many has been said already about the quality of the papers, and I just want to reinforce points that were said before. So I do agree with Steve in terms of existent uncertainty. I would expect these to be very minor or almost inexistent if we are able to build up a scope that will filter into the model. And filter was a word used by Steve in our conversation. Filter into the model only the schemes that we do believe deserves the application of the model, and then I'll turn to worded by Martin in terms to properly reflect the economic performance of those entities. So I think this aspect of uncertainty we should take care of in the scoping process.
Yeah.
As the issue of measurement, and particularly the adjustments that Martin made reference, I think this is an important aspect, and in the discussion paper process we can have the opportunity to thoroughly explore that, because so far of course our experience is limited to our outreach power during the development of the process. So I think it's a point for us to try and understand that. My experience, at least in my region, is that the level of adjustments is, as a result of the negotiation with the regulator, is very limited, is very low, because this, again, is filtered through the regulatory scheme, regulatory agreement, generally a law or a specific regulation. And as for the other points, I really appreciate the comments made by Gary on the uncertainty and the measurement. I would just mention that if something that really grabbed my attention in here for us to explore more in the next phase could be the demand risks that is faced by the entity, at least for us to clearly understand what sort of effect this can have in the model.
Thank you.
Mary?
Mara's last comment makes me want to just say, okay, setting aside the items for which it's demand, where the uncertainty is demand risk, I get an adjustment, but there's uncertainty about it, whether I'll be able to collect it. As I said, I'd like to go back and look at those against whether they meet the scope criteria or not, you know, in terms of the differentiation from competitive, you know, outside the scope issue. So set those aside for the population that we're looking at with something, and I'll use the storm damage versus regular as kind of the poster child to say that category, where there's some judgment at the reporting date about what the ultimate outcome of the rate setting process will be, even in a well-established setting, you know, the kind of situation Gary was talking about. I think we should have an explicit, you know, threshold for recognition. And as I think through alternatives, you know, you said you just are looking for preliminary views, and this is going to Chung Wu's point in particular about paragraph 21. As I look at the range of possibilities, I come back to probable. And my reasons for coming back to probable in part go to IFRS 15. Now, IFRS 15 essentially has two thresholds in it, one of which is probable and one of which is highly probable. Highly probable is for variable consideration. And that's a really unusual thing that we introduced into the standard because we heard that the revenue number is special, and people didn't want revenue, which they use as measures of growth, you know, volume, etc., distorted by re-estimation of prior period events. So for that reason, we identified a specific subset of revenue amounts that we subjected to an extra hurdle of highly probable that there wouldn't be significant reversals. Okay. But when I step back and think about IFRS 15 as a whole, we made a decision in terms of the scope that you're in, our threshold is probable, that you'll be collecting the amounts to which you expect to be entitled. So to me, the basic threshold for a transaction in 15 is a probability, you know, is a basic probable test. And on that basis, assuming that the adjustment that we're talking about for rate-regulated activities is an adjustment of profitability but not an adjustment of the revenue number, because the revenue number is the P times Q for sales to customers, then I think I would look to the more thinking about the basic model in 15 of probable rather than the unusual one that we introduced for a subset in 15 of highly probable. Now, Martin raised the point about a lot of entities that are kind of what we think about rate regulated may have more incentive components built in. I think, but this is just a reaction at the table, so maybe staff has to go off and assess this, that the structure and the focus of this project, which is on accounting for the adjustments that the regulatory process entitles you to, copes with a lot of that variability, apart from the ones I said let's set aside and look at separately. Because Martin, if you say that you get an adjustment, but only if your, let's say your costs are, you know, more than X amount, you know, if then you don't have an adjustment within the plus or minus band. So I think that because we are focusing only on the adjustment entitlement, we might deal with some, in the structure of the model, some of that. So that may take a bunch of the, a slice of the variability out of the model and what we're trying to account for, and that may help. And if so, if what we're talking about is existence uncertainty, the storm damage example, will it be allowed as an additional item? I think if we have a probability hurdle, and then use some kind of, then we can think about what the measurement method is to factor in the various possible outcomes. I'd like to distinguish the measurement method from the explicit hurdle for recognition. And as I said, my preliminary view right now is probable is the right test for that.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question to Mary? Because you said it is different from revenue. Revenue, if you have variable consideration, which I think is an answer, and then you need high probable, because revenue is special, because investors, users want to have trend information and don't. My understanding is they don't want to have adjustments through the revenue number, because that will destroy all that. But my earlier point was I see that exactly in the same way here, because maybe doing all that because we want to show economic profitability. And if that is destroyed, then this kind of trend information, what is really the probability by high adjustments, because it is only probable, I don't see any difference to the revenue number. Because even if you don't maybe won't have the adjustment in the revenue number, but I see it similar to that, because if we don't want to have this kind of thing, why do we do the overall project? Because it isn't P&L project to better reflect on people making what is the economic profitability performance of these companies. And if it is destroyed by adjustments because, okay, it was maybe probable, but okay, it was not highly probable, and you have all this kind of adjustments all the time, I don't think it is worthwhile to do this project.
Well, I think it's a good challenge for the staff to go up and think about probable versus highly probable, given our experience in revenue and what we heard. But I can see, first reaction is I can see the validity of making a distinction between a number that adjusts the top line, which of course is your starting point for the volume is the starting point for your measure of profitability. But I think we heard that there are other reasons and other ways people use the revenue number. It's not just as an input to your calculation of profitability, but measuring growth, volume, et cetera. It's why they care about the principal versus agent and gross versus net. That said that they wanted to keep that clean from subsequent adjustments. And I think one of the advantages that we have with the approach, the very fundamental approach that the staff has taken, which is that the rate accounting for the effects of the adjustment amounts would be segregated and presented separately, allows people to distinguish, here's my measure of ongoing operating performance versus the impact of rate regulation, so that I can I think it could be differentiated from what we were hearing about the top line revenue number, but I'd say give that input to the staff and ask them to think about it.
I wanted to explain myself, people. Probably
we have a higher probability threshold for variable consideration, I suppose, because there's a higher risk of adjustments.
Yes.
Because it's less sure, right? And that was the real reason also, because the regulators like that. The question then is, would these rate regulated regulatory assets and liabilities, would they have the same kind of uncertainty that would justify and risk of adjustments later on that would justify a higher threshold than what we had for normal revenue?
Yeah.
That's the question.
Yeah, that is, but it's also the question of does it make, is the analysis different if those adjustments are segregated from the revenue number? Because part of what we were hearing that drove us to that higher threshold is when I look at revenue, I want to know what happened in the period. I don't want to know what happened in the period plus my assessment of the adjustments of a prior period, et cetera, and does the segregation, and I'm really asking that as a question, does the segregation impact our analysis differently when we look at these types of adjustments versus revenue?
But for me, it's a fundamental issue because my probably means for me 50%. So, but on the other hand side, I would think there is a chance that kind of this adjustment which we do to P&L is a 50% chance that they are have to be adjusted in future periods and revised. And if it is a 50% kind of probability that these numbers which we do to reflect better performance has to be adjusted in future, I think it's not worth to do it. Yeah. And maybe, okay, when Gary had said that is all kind of clear and people know that, and if that is true, then I think we can use high probable because it is all certain. So I see kind of we have to do a little bit more work to understand, is there many adjustments, are there material, and so that was my point.
Amaru?
Just in this very same point, I think it's again, as I mentioned, it's a valid point, but if we are successful again in this terms of scoping what is filtered into the project, I think this will be reduced significantly, almost to zero, and then we'll come back to the probable, because probable is the, our recent thinking in IFRIC 23, is the thinking for recognition in general. So I think Martin's point is basically a suggestion for staff and, of course, for us to really have more, try to get more if adjustments are that frequent. My personal experience is that they are not, so I'm comfortable, but I think it's an important point, and then this will be filtered again through this scope.
Stephen?
Accounting is full of catch-up adjustments, and what's important, I think, for investors is that they understand what's going on. So what's an adjustment with respect to prior periods and what isn't. But they recognize that there is a catch-up process and that some items in the current period don't necessarily relate to economic activity in the current period. There are a revision of an estimate made in the previous period for the economic activity in that period. But I think that deferring stuff into a future period because it's uncertain has a negative effect on the prior period. So suppose I have a rate-regulated entity and I've got revenue of 100, but I've got a regulatory asset recognized, a regulatory gain in the P&L because of something that's happened in that period. Saying, let's suppose that's uncertain, maybe it's probable but not highly probable, and we therefore on this basis start putting it in the next period, well, you've affected the usefulness of the first period's results, because now you've got a revenue of 100, no gain, and you've got all the costs which you incurred, but you think it's probable you're going to recover those additional costs, let's say, that you incurred in that period. So I mean, we did revenue recognition and the highly probable for lots of reasons, but I'm not I wouldn't want that to be used as a model for all future decisions in terms of uncertainty, because putting in the highly probable threshold has its own sort of negative consequences. I accept the revenue is special and the regulatory interest in that number. But I'm not sure that I would agree with a highly probable threshold for these things. If the thing is really uncertain, then the problem with accounting is that doing a point estimate doesn't capture the uncertainty. So if things are really uncertain, then you need more supplementary disclosures to capture that uncertainty. If it was so uncertain that the point estimate has no real usefulness, well, we're better off just having disclosure and not recognizing the first place, which is exactly what the framework says. But I don't think it should go automatically to this highly probable threshold.
Well, my understanding so far is that if we had a rate-regulated entity, let's call it that way, or an entity that operates in this type of environment, but the price for the next period would be totally open to negotiation, I guess we would not put that entity into the scope. So to me, the issue of those negotiations that may arise would be in the fringe. And the comparison I would make to IFRS 15 would then not be the comparison of the variable compensation, because variable compensation is an element that is defined in the contract, and you have a probability of reaching this or that amount, you don't know, but you have a rate. I was more making the comparison to the situation where I would have, in IFRS 15, a contract with a customer. I have performed under an agreed price. We both know that it has been much more difficult than it was expected to be, and it was just not foreseen in the contract that there could be any supplement in price. But the customer is satisfied, and I'm going to enter into a negotiation with that customer and see whether he would agree to an increased amount. And those negotiations, frankly, exist. It's not because you're not necessary in an environment where your customer is going to say, well, too bad for you, I mean, I accepted your price and no more. So to me, the analogy was more to this kind of situation. And in IFRS 15, as long as the customer has not signed up to the incremental amount, we would not recognize anything. It would just not be a signed contract. So that the analogy I was making for these negotiations was on that basis, much more than it was on variable compensation.
And I think that's a variation from the contract rather than an interpretation of
a variation that is possible but has not been agreed upon.
Are there any more comments or questions?
Just if people have got comments on 9A.
Any questions on the first paper?
The second paper. 9B.
9A. I would tend to say no new comment.
No new comment.
I wanted to say something on 9A if I could. So on 9A, just more, I guess, questions for you, Jane, and perhaps suggestions for articulation if you agree. I think, as you know, for me, it's not determinative whether I'd want to do this project or not, whether it's something we consider on liability in the first place, because I think I could personally justify it on the basis of useful information. But I know that you and the board wants to try and use the asset and liability definitions if we can, so in the spirit of that. I guess the thing that, as I understand it, is what we're trying to account for is the sort of true-up adjustments. So it's the sort of unders and overs that we're particularly focusing on and that we're trying to capture in this accounting model, because it's what's sort of unique about this defined rate regulation as we've scoped it. And
it didn't come across to me as strongly as I had expected, I guess, in paper 9A, that it was that sort of true-up amount that we were focusing on to try and decide whether it met the definition of an asset or a liability. We talk about favourable and unfavourable rates, but that to me in itself wouldn't have necessarily, if I didn't know all of our discussions, have made me realise that we were talking about the unders and overs. And I think it's important for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because when we talk about whether something's a favourable or unfavourable amount, I think you could have a situation where, I don't know, you had just a cost recovery type contract where you thought you're going to have 100 per annum of cost, so you'd set your rate on that basis. Turns out in the first year it's 105. You're going to recover that 5 next year, so you're going to get a plus 5, which I think is favourable. But you may already know your costs are going to be 115 in that year, so it's actually not favourable overall. It's just a positive adjustment relative to my previously agreed 100. So I think it's important for me to focus on favourable or unfavourable in the context of the true-up amount in isolation as opposed to the rate overall. The other reason why I think that would help me is that I completely agree with your analysis that there are, you know, rights and obligations, and you have control over those rights and obligations. So I'm fine with that in the paper, so I agree with all of that analysis. But for me, the reason why I want to be clear about what the bit is that I'm focusing on to decide whether it's an asset or a liability is I want to work out whether I've really got a right to a future economic benefit or an obligation to transfer economic resources. And to make that decision, I need to know sort of what my outflows are in exchange for the inflows. So if I could think about it super simplistically, and this is a sort of a question for you to think about, not necessarily for today, if I could think about the... So I'm thinking about rate regulation, and we've already decided not to account for the entire thing. We've decided just to focus on the contract. We've also decided not to focus on the entire rate, but to focus on the true-up. So if we could go the further step and say really what we're just focusing on is the right or obligation to receive an additional amount or receive less amount in the future, and think about the services as being with the IFRS 15 accounting. So I could just look at the stream of cash. That for me would be a much simpler way to think about it, and a clear focus on future economic benefits and obligations to transfer resources, because I don't have to think about the value of the services in exchange for that.
Yeah, I think that's we'll need to give it more thought, but I think that's a fair way of looking at things, because we're not saying that core rate is the value, it's the price that's allocated to those services, and what we're trying to capture is those timing differences where things don't quite line up.
You agreed with that. I think it would be a much simpler articulation of why these are assets and liabilities that I think would help, certainly help me, and I think it would help people try to understand how we're applying our new definitions as well. Anyway, something for you to think about.
Thank you.
Mary?
Could I just say times two for what Sue just said, and then maybe add two thoughts onto it? In saying times two about the favorable, unfavorable, I caution against use of those labels, because I think it always raises the question of favorable compared to what? To what it would be if I weren't regulated, to the level of margin, et cetera. So I think if we think of them as positive and negative adjustment amounts, you know, it's bland. You aren't going to win any marketing campaign, you know, slogan campaigns with that, but I think it may be a more neutral description. But the other thing I was thinking about as I looked at paper 9A and the analysis against the conceptual framework definitions, I'm going to raise a concern and then ask staff to go away and think about being creative rather to avoid getting caught up in something that could be a huge distraction. But it's a problem for me now, which is I think I want to be able to point to something that says, here's why Amaro's ability, you know, the Amaro is a rate-regulated entity, his right to raise prices in future or his obligation to reduce prices in future are assets and liabilities. when my ability is non-rate regulated, which is in some ways freer because I'm not subject to maybe anything more than I might have market cap, but I might not even have that. My ability to raise rates or my decision to lower rates is not a right and obligation that we would account for in the financial statements. You know, call me Tesco's or Sainsbury's or somebody like that, and trying to make this distinction. We could go into long philosophical debates, or maybe we should just be focusing on here's the mix of characteristics that say in these cases we want to account for the effects, not the value, but the effects of rate regulation, because here are the characteristics that are the package that make these different, that make Amaro's right to raise his prices different from mine. And so rather than going through a generic analysis that might apply to everybody, I'd suggest really trying to use the characteristics to filter down to the special kinds that we're trying to analyze rather than the generic kinds that are everybody in terms of kind of bringing a revised version of non-A back.
Yep.
Okay. I think we have reached the end of our discussion. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.